This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. Our next guest, Richard Cohen, was diagnosed 40 years ago with MS. At the time he was diagnosed, he worked in TV production and he hid his diagnosis from everyone because he says back then there was no treatment and the diagnosis was what he says it was a death sentence. For anyone who is close to MS now, we know that is no longer the case. And 40 years later, Cohen has explored stem cell therapy. He has newfound hope and he's done it alongside his wife, journalist and TV host Meredith Vieira. Cohen explores the many aspects of living with MS in his new book, Chasing Hope, A Patient's Deep Dive into Stem Cells, Faith, and the Future. Richard Cohen, welcome to The Mountain Life. Nice to have you.
Thank you very much.
You were diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, MS, 4 decades ago. That's 40 years you've been living with deteriorating sight and the other signs and symptoms of MS. You call it the elephant in the room. Take us back 4 decades ago. Can you talk a little bit about the diagnosis and the treatment that you received at the time?
Sure. You know, there was an expression that some neurologists came up with, diagnose in adios, meaning, I'm sorry you got it so long. You know, there were virtually no treatments. I mean, when I was diagnosed, and it was over the telephone by a neurologist who just sort of told me, made no mention of ever seeing me again, and I was very much on my own and didn't have any treatments for the MS for many decades.
And so you just went along accepting each of the new changes in your body and especially your sight?
Well, the sight was really the critical one because I was already in the news business, in television news. Mm-hmm. And being half blind in a visual medium is not exactly ideal.
Yeah.
And basically, I kept the illness a secret for a lot of years because I knew that nobody would hire me if they knew that I had it. And I just sort of lived by my wits and just did okay and never shared it with anybody for a very long time.
Richard, how is that to live with MS and not share it? I mean, maybe you could help our listeners understand the progression of MS and how a person is able to live with it for decades and not have the rest of the world and even employers and fellow peers at work know that you have MS.
Well, it's not easy, really, because if you've ever been with somebody who doesn't see too well, you notice it pretty quickly. I didn't show a lot of symptoms for a good number of years. I was very lucky. I mean, I worked in the news business for a long time and traveled all over the world, covered wars and presidential campaigns, and got by. And you've just got to be resolute. You've got to think of different ways to do things that are not necessarily traditional. I mean, I wasn't able to drive for a very long time. You know, I mean, I haven't driven since I was 25 years old or something. And I even, in the early years when I wasn't telling anybody, when I was at CBS for the Cronkite broadcast, I hitchhiked to stories sometimes, which was preposterous. But those are the things you had to do. But, you know, there's a real sense of isolation, you know, when you live this way. It's a very lonely way to exist. Because, you know, you are your own confidant, you are your own best friend, and when you're not telling anybody, it's just very lonely, you know. And but the world, you know, it was a great job, and I wasn't going to give it up, you know, people said to me, including doctors, you know, look, news is stressful and demanding physically. Don't do it. Get out. Do something else. And I was just utterly determined to stick with it and make a go of it, and it worked.
And how's the landscape changed over those four decades when, you know, when you were 25 and hitchhiking to do stories and really making your way and fending for yourself and being isolated? And I would imagine a lot of people were in that same situation 40 years ago. And have things changed as far as acceptance and maybe even a support and even treatment, which you described as harsh and invasive, which I'm sure wasn't pleasant to deal with. Have things changed in a way that somebody in your position today would have a different experience?
You know, the more things change, the less they change. And especially in tough economic times. I mean, people with chronic illnesses, not just MS, but many other illnesses, and by the way, it correlates to age, and as we become the oldest population in the history of the country, literally half the population has a chronic illness, at least one chronic illness. And employers don't want to deal with it. You know, I think that employers automatically think that we cannot do, you know, and we have to work much harder to prove ourselves. And I don't think they cut us a lot of slack. And that's how it was back then, and I'm afraid that's how it is now. And I would advise anybody diagnosed with MS or any other illness like MS, keep it to yourself if you can, because you can't count on the open attitude of any employer.
Well, it seems to me that it's about understanding and educating the rest of the population. It seems in recent years I've known so many more people that have been diagnosed with MS, and it's made me understand about the treatment, about some of the different, you know, the stem cell therapy, the, you know, things like Terry Walls and the Walls protocol diet. And it would seem to me that if the rest of us were educated about it, it wouldn't need to be something that is hidden in the closet. Do you agree with that? I guess,
well,
maybe you don't.
Yeah, in theory, you're absolutely right. But I think we live in a culture that celebrates, you know, beauty and physical perfection. And I think people are not malicious. You know, I don't think they wish us ill or anything like that. But I just don't think people see us. I think that people avert their eyes. You know, I don't think people want to know about illness. And I think that's the way it's always been. And I don't know that it really has changed that much or is going to change that much. And, you know, it's just very tough, and I found, you know, even as much as professional challenges, I thought social challenges were very, very difficult, and nothing seemed to be any different, you know. And again, it was a pretty tough way to live.
Well, let's get into how you first discovered stem cell therapy. And I know it is a very, very invasive procedure. In fact, a friend of mine just went through it a couple months ago for MS. But you talk about a little visit to the Vatican with your wife, Meredith Vieira, when you first found out about stem cell therapy.
Yeah, no, we were invited. This was in 2012. We were invited to go to a conference, participate at the Vatican in 2013, and I chaired the opening panel, which was about autoimmune diseases. And it was fascinating because scientists from all over the world were there, opinion leaders and politicians and the rest. And I had always thought that I had always taken a sort of a futuristic view of stem cells. And I was shocked to realize how much was going on right now, you know, that for almost any illness or any problem you can name, there was serious research on cell therapy. And I left the Vatican thinking, geez, you know, I mean, I would love to be treated. I mean, I had no qualms about it. And one of the people who spoke there was a doctor in New York who was doing stem cell or had an application into the FDA for a clinical trial. And he invited me to come see him. And I ended up becoming his patient. And I was the first one he treated in a clinical trial that proved to be very successful.
Richard, I'm wondering about the convergence of religion and science that you experienced when you realized that the future is now, and science in the form of stem cell treatment and research had advanced so far, and you were at the Vatican, a hub and nexus of religion. Was that part of the experience for you? Was looking at how you were exploring scientific frontiers through a religious lens?
Well, actually, there are a couple of points that I would raise, you know, answering that question. One is that they do very serious science at the Vatican, and they have people from all over the world, the researchers and doctors who come in, and they invite people regardless of race, religion, nationality. And it really is a hidden but a wonderful enterprise. But the other point that needs to be made is that opposition, church opposition to stem cells has always been embryonic stem cells. And the trend in medicine now is to use adult cells because they're more reliable. And what they do is they use what they call, they call it autologous cells, and it means using your own stem cells. The trial I was on, and I used my own stem cells harvested from bone marrow taken from my chest. And that means that there's less rejection and less danger to it. And, of course, it guarantees that they're going to be adult cells. And the Vatican, mindful of the controversy over their position on embryonic stem cells, they were very anxious to have this conference on adult stem cells because they wanted to get out from under the controversy. They wanted to get back in the forefront of medical research. And I found that in our time at the Vatican, there was never a mention of religion, you know, and we were dealing with, the person who sponsored it, Cardinal Rabasi, who's very high up in the hierarchy there, you know, in the Curia, which is the inner sort of powerhouse, he never said a word, and he was very welcoming. And so religion really had little to do with it. Where religion came into it for me was just my inquiry about hope, because I never was comfortable with the idea that you had to link hope with faith. You know, I'm not much of a believer, but I do have hope. And I talked to members of the clergy from just about every religion, and heard wildly different things, and they were actually all great people and very smart and very articulate, and I understood where they were coming from, and they just all, many of them differed from each other.
Well, before we go down the path of linking hope and faith, which is a big conversation and topic, let me ask you about the state of being of stem cell therapy and research today versus 2012, because in this world that we live in, 6 years, in the realms of what's happening on the cutting edge of medicine and science is an eternity, or so it seems. And I know 6 years goes by in a flash, and I look at 2012, and on paper it looks like such a recent number. But I would imagine an awful lot has happened, not only for you, but just in general with respect to stem cells.
Oh, that's absolutely true. I mean, the trial I was on, and which was a phase one trial, basically for safety, it was so positive that the FDA immediately approved a phase two trial, and it's already changed. The technology has already changed. We're really almost at the start, in historic terms, we're right at the starting line. I mean, this is so early in the game, and I truly believe, and lots of other people truly believe, that cell therapy is going to be the future of medicine. I think that the possibilities are enormous, and it may play out way past my lifetime, but I think it's going to change medicine radically and very positively.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Richard Cohen. He's written a book called Chasing Hope, A Patient's Deep Dive into Stem Cells, Faith, and the Future. He's a New York Times bestselling author, previously of the book Blindsided.
This book, it is revealing, it's serious, it's humorous. It's an exploration of your journey, having lived with MS for 40 years. I'm wondering about the phase one stem cell therapy. What were the outcomes, the immediate outcomes that you experienced that you either expected or didn't expect?
Well, what happened to me, which was pretty unusual, was that 1 month after the first infusion, I had a life-threatening pulmonary embolism, which is a blood clot in your lungs, that kills more people than not. And I was very lucky to survive that. And I think that undid a lot of the good that would have come from the stem cell infusions. And so my results were not as dramatic as other people. But some people in that phase one trial got up out of wheelchairs. And that's pretty dramatic, you know. And the changes for me were incremental. I walk a little better and I stand a little straighter. You know, when you're sick, you'll take anything you can get. But I'm going to keep going with it. He's agreed to treat me in the phase two trial. And we're going to just have to see.
I've heard of people going back for a second round of stem cell therapy to treat their MS. And we've said already that it's such an invasive procedure. Can you talk about the length and what has to happen to go through the procedure?
Well, again, they're all different depending on what your problem is. Mm-hmm. I have lesions in my brain and brainstem, so the procedure I had was a spinal infusion, and it sounds much more hideous than it is, where they numb your skin and they you basically just sit up and bend forward. I was just wearing my street clothes and they just taped my shirt up and the needle went into my spinal column. And he did three separate injections and injected 10s of thousands of stem cells into my system. And it sounds a lot worse than it is. And I would do it again because I think it's worth it. And it really is not that painful. What was a little uncomfortable was the process leading up to it. I mean, one funny story is that I had to have bone marrow taken from my chest because that's where this kind of stem cell resides. And it's done by a hematologist, a blood doctor, and I lay on my back. We videotaped this for my blog, and they literally put something like a corkscrew into your chest. And I was a little nervous about that, and Meredith was there. She actually videotaped it, and she asked a nurse before it started how painful it was. And the nurse said, "It's not really painful," she said. "It just feels like your chest is being crushed." And I thought, oh, phew.
That's good.
That's good. I really feel much better now.
Well, Richard, let's talk quickly about, I think we're sort of running down on time, but just your experience, and because of your illness and what you've been through, you have firsthand, in what I would call, you know, either acute or tangible experience with hope. And you refer to, you know, this stem cell therapy opening the door to hope for you for the first time in your adult life. And then it also gets connected in many ways to an element of faith. And I'm assuming, and I know you've had an awful lot of time to think about that and to come to some position on a connection between hope and faith.
Yeah, for me it was much more faith in the process and really faith in myself. I think hope, I never think of hope as, you know, wishing for a specific thing. You know, I hope I get that job or I get that date or whatever it is. I think hope is just an outlook on life. You know, I think hope is feeling positive, feeling good about yourself, feeling good about your life, and being open to possibility. And I all of those things apply to me. I have a great wife, a great life and a great wife, and I've got great kids. And, you know, I don't have any complaints. You know, I just live with what, we all live with what we got to deal with. And it could be worse. You know, you want a good coping mechanism. Look around you and see the suffering, and you'll realize that for many, if not most of us, life could be a whole lot worse. So that's just my personal view of hope. And but, you know, you could ask 10 people and you'll get 11 different theories.
Mm. Well, the book is Chasing Hope, A Patient's Deep Dive into Stem Cells, Faith, and the Future. Our guest is Richard Cohen. Richard, thank you so much for joining us and for writing this book.
Thank you so much.